This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. 40 years ago today, Robert Kennedy won the Democratic primary in California, keeping him in the race. He made his victory speech late that night, and after it was over, shortly after midnight, he was shot 3 times. He died the following day. We're going to remember Kennedy today. Our first guest is journalist and novelist Pete Hamill. He was a friend of Kennedy's, helped convince him to run for president, worked briefly on his campaign, then wrote about the campaign. He was with Kennedy the night he was shot and was one of the men who tried to tackle the assassin, Sirhan Sirhan. Hamill wrote the introduction to a new book of photographs of Kennedy by Bill Epridge called A Time It Was, Bobby Kennedy in the 60s. Pete Hamill, welcome to Fresh Air. How did you first get to know Bobby Kennedy?
I had gone to cover the war, an early part of the war in Vietnam, at the very end of 65, so I was there for Christmas and New Year's and a couple of weeks after that. And this was for the New York Post. Bobby had already been elected senator from New York, but I didn't know him because I was not a political writer. When I got back, there was a note waiting for me from Bobby saying, "I loved your pieces from Vietnam. When you're back, please give me a call." And so I did. It was as simple as that. And I went and met him and liked him very much. When I was a much younger man, I didn't think he was great. Before the assassination of his brother, he had worked for Joe McCarthy and other people in Washington that, as a good card-carrying 25-year-old liberal, I didn't approve of. But when I met him, I understood that he had learned something from the assassination of his brother. It was about time. Bobby's realization that you can't wait. You have to do the thing in the now while you can. And I loved that about him.
Since it was the war in Vietnam that brought you both together, what views did you or didn't you share about the war?
We both agreed with the way that the country had to go ahead because the war was tearing us apart before he ran for president. He knew that somehow they had to go to a negotiating table somewhere and negotiate an end to the war. That didn't happen, I think, because he was assassinated and another 20-odd thousand Americans were killed, and by one estimate, at least 1 million Vietnamese were killed before it stopped in 1975. So I think he knew there was an urgency to that, that it was hurting our image around the world, very much like Iraq is now, and that you had to get at it. You had to sit down with people at a table and say, okay, let's make sense out of this thing.
You wrote Bobby Kennedy a letter urging him to run for president. I'd like you to read that letter for us.
Yeah, it was written right after the Tet Offensive began. My brother John, who was 18 at the time, was a soldier in Vietnam, and we began to see things happening there. I was very upset about it, listening. I was in Ireland listening to the BBC, trying to get news. And when Bobby finally said that he absolutely was not going to challenge Lyndon Johnson for the presidency, I sat down and read and wrote him this letter. "Dear Bob, I had wanted to write you a long letter explaining my reasons why I thought you should make a run for the presidency this year. But that's too late. I read in the Irish Times this morning that you made a hard announcement, and that small hope is gone, along with others that have vanished in the last 4 years. I suspect that all nations have their historical moment, some moment when it all seems to have been put together as an idea. Our moment was 1960 to 1963. I don't think it's nostalgia working or romanticism. I think most Americans feel that way now. The moment is gone now, and we have grown accustomed to living in a country where nobody would protest very much if Jack Valenti replaced John Gardner. I wanted to say that the fight you might make would be the fight of honor. I wanted to say that you should run because if you won, the country might be saved. If we have LBJ for another 4 years, there won't be much of a country left. I've heard the arguments about the practical politics which are involved. You will destroy the Democratic Party. You will destroy yourself. I say that if you don't run, you might destroy the Democratic Party. It will end up nationally the way it has in New York, a party filled with decrepit old bastards like Gabe Beam and young hustlers with blue hair trying to get their hands on highway contracts. It will be a party that says to millions and millions of people that they don't count, that the decision of 2,000 hack Pauls does. They will say that idealism is a cynical joke, that hard-headed pragmatism is the rule, even if the pragmatists rule in the style of Bonnie and Clyde. I wanted to remind you that in Watts I didn't see pictures of Malcolm X or Ron Karenga on the walls. I saw pictures of John F. Kennedy. That is your capital in the most cynical sense. It is your obligation in another. The obligation of staying true to whatever it was that put those pictures on those walls. I don't think we can afford 5 summers of blood. I do know this. If a 15-year-old kid is given a choice between Rap Brown and Robert F. Kennedy, he might choose the way of sanity. It's only a possibility, but at least there is that chance. Give that same kid a choice between Rap Brown and LBJ, and he'll probably reach for his revolver. Again, forgive the tone of this letter, Bob, but it's not about 5-cent cigars and chickens in every pot. It's about the country. I don't want to sound like someone telling someone that he should mount the white horse or that he should destroy his career. I also realize that if you had decided to run, you would face some filthy politics, and that there are plenty of people in the country who resent or dislike you. With all of that, I still think the move would have been worth making, and I'm sorry you decided not to make it.
So what was the response to the letter?
Well, what I heard later from other people, because I was in Ireland, not in Washington, is that Kennedy carried it around with him for weeks and showed it to various people, friends, people who had worked for John Kennedy, family members, etc., asking, what do you think? What do you think? Apparently, it had some effect. When Lyndon Johnson finally decided not to run again, Kennedy was then free, and he announced almost immediately after that. And I got a telegram in Ireland saying, I've taken your advice. Come home and go. Let's go to work. And I got on the first plane the next day and went back and worked for a while for the campaign, but not too long. I found out that I was a newspaper man and not somebody who worked on campaigns, but I left and then covered the campaign up until the end.
What were you supposed to be doing in the campaign?
Basically writing speeches, but, they had some very good people, Jeff Greenfield, Adam Walensky, people like that who were writing speeches. And also to be around where ideas were kicked around. What if we said this? You know, that kind of thing. And I would react as a newspaper man saying, no, if you do that, somebody's going to say this. You know? But I obviously wasn't very good at it. And around any campaign, the most idealistic campaign, there are people with sharp elbows who are looking to a future different from what you might look for, which is to go to the end and then go home.
Do you think that Robert Kennedy's brother's assassination affected his decision to run for president?
Yes. It affected all of those 5 years after the assassination in Dallas. I think he learned so many things about the sense of urgency, a sense of time, a sense of true idealism, the sense of what the menu was for a politician, which in the United States had to be civil rights and, above all, that war. He understood also that the young were not the same as people when he was young, near the end of World War II. They had other visions. They had rock and roll. They had drugs. They had all kinds of things that triumphed a year later in Woodstock, symbolically, I mean. And I think he knew that if you could do it at all as a politician, if you could direct all that amazing, idealistic energy, that the country truly would change, that we would get off this path that we were locked into because of the larger umbrella of the Cold War and begin to see the world as a much more complicated place. And that's why I think he was consumed with making the change but was torn, Wendy, because he was a regular Democrat. That's why Mayor Daley could stand with Tom Hayden on the night of the funeral in St. Patrick's. He respected the old Tammany Hall guys in New York, the Mayor Curleys, the Daleys in Chicago, the Pendergast in Kansas City. He respected those guys because they were essentially a non-ideological organization. Corrupt, yes, but they knew how to take care of their people. And I think he respected that along with the need for reform. So it was the contradictions, I think, resulted in a lot of the passion.
How did Bobby Kennedy feel about being the candidate, the front man? You know, when his brother was alive, Kennedy was more the behind-the-scenes person.
Yes, and that changed with the campaign in New York. When he finally came to New York and ran for senator against Keating and won, it was the first time he'd been out front on his own. He was literally his brother's the word servant is not the accurate, but he served that cause because he loved his brother and respected him and understood the complexity of things and understood something that few politicians do, irony. He understood that there was a difference between what was said and what was done. So he understood the irony of someone, namely himself, being the person for whom thousands roared in a public place. There was something laughable about it on one level, and he realized they were not just cheering him, they were cheering the whole thing that the Kennedys stood for at that time.
My guest is Pete Hamill. He wrote the introduction to a new collection of photographs of Bobby Kennedy called A Time It Was. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're devoting today's show to the memory of Robert Kennedy. He was assassinated 40 years ago. Let's get back to our interview with journalist Pete Hamill, who was a friend of Kennedy's and was with him the night he was killed. When you wrote the letter to Bobby Kennedy urging him to run for the presidency, assassination was very much on your mind. You
yes.
Certainly knew about his brother's assassination. You were in Ireland at the time you wrote the letter, finishing up a thriller you were writing about
yes.
the assassination of the Pope.
Yes.
So when you urged Bobby Kennedy to run for president, did you think at all, well, maybe this would leave him vulnerable to assassination himself?
You know, I did, because there had been a couple of other assassinations, Malcolm X, Medgar Evers. There were then, as now, millions of guns in the country and not more than a few nuts. So it was a possibility. But I had never really talked to him about the assassination until I mentioned in this letter the pictures on the walls as I saw in Watts. And I didn't know how to raise it, so I didn't have a conversation that said, look, some nut could be out there. But I didn't think I needed to. In his eyes, there was almost always, in the photographs in this book that we're talking about, you can see it in the eyes. There was a kind of fatalism that it could happen to Jack, it could happen to anybody. And so I felt not that I shouldn't raise it, and I regretted that. I regret it now, insofar as that letter propelled him into the race. I feel bad about that. I wish he was around right now, 83 or 84 years old, sitting in a rocker and talking about the good times when he was president, or not president, when Jack was president, and not what in fact happened. And then when it happened, it felt like there could have been no other ending, Wendy. You know, you just walked around and said, why didn't I say something? Why did I do this, that, or the other?
Let's talk about your memories of the night Bobby Kennedy was killed. It was a big night for his presidential campaign, the night of the California primary. Why was that so important?
Well, politically, he had lost the primary the week before in Oregon to Eugene McCarthy. So if he lost California, he could not go to the convention in August try to make a case that he's the one that could win the election. So he had to win California. It was a different era in the sense that on that evening when we assembled, various of us, in a couple of different rooms at the Ambassador Hotel on the fifth floor, you know, there were no cable television shows. There were no cell phones. There was, a phone would ring, someone pick it up and come over and whisper. You know, you didn't know. But there was a sense, a gathering sense all that week that he was going to win California. To begin with, he had become the first American candidate for president who had rallied the Mexican Americans. And I think that had to do with something else, because I've been going to Mexico for 50 years and know many, many Mexicans. They have exactly the same fatalistic look at the world that the Irish have. I think their sense that what will be, was present, and they saw it in Kennedy, and it made him even more attractive than the simple political allegiances that he was calling forth. So it looked like he was going to win, but nobody knew. And as the evening moved on, I was talking at one point to the movie director, John Frankenheimer. Bobby had stayed the night before at Frankenheimer's house in Malibu, because Frankenheimer was making TV commercials for the campaign. And he drove Bobby all the way to the Ambassador Hotel that evening. His sense of remorse later was something like mine and many others. He kept saying at one conversation, what if I'd only gotten a flat tire? What if I, you know, that kind of sense of replaying time, which you can never do. So there was a sense that you could win. And then when the news finally came, people shouted and cheered and started getting dressed to go down to the ballroom.
You went down to the ballroom.
I did. I went down in the freight elevator with Kennedy and Bill Barry, who was the head of security, and four or five other people jammed into this freight elevator down to the back of the ballroom, which opened onto the kitchen. And we all got up on the stage behind Kennedy. I was in the very last row, and George Plimpton was beside me, and he realized that there was no wall behind the curtain we were leaning on and warned everybody. We all laughed, and then Kennedy came and made his acceptance speech, which ended with on to Chicago. And then we turned to go back into the kitchen. Half the stage turned left and half the stage turned right because there were no paths, really. And I ended up in the actual room where the steam tables were and an old rusty ice machine and a few other things. And Kennedy was walking towards us. I was walking backwards, making notes of what he was doing. There were a number of his people right behind him. And then he turned to shake hands with one of three Mexican busboys who were at the end of the steam tables that are in a lot of the pictures, a fellow named Juan Romero. And as he was shaking hands and turned to face this fellow, turned to his own left, pap, 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 the shots rang out.
Pete Hamill will describe what happened next in the second half of the show. Hamill wrote the introduction to a new book collecting Bill Eppridge's photos of Robert Kennedy called A Time It Was. Hamill's novel North River has just been published in paperback. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're remembering Robert F. Kennedy on the 40th anniversary of his assassination. After giving a speech late in the night declaring victory in the June 4th California Democratic primary, he was shot three times. Let's get back to our interview with journalist and novelist Pete Hamill. He was a friend of Kennedy's, worked briefly for his campaign, and was with him the night he was assassinated. When we left off, Hamill had just described hearing the gunshots. Did you know right away what was happening?
Yes, because I turned and I saw a fellow, this guy, who turned out to be Sirhan Sirhan, his right leg planted forward and the gun straight out. It was about, I don't know, 3 feet from Kennedy's head. And he was directly to my right. And it was a real gun. And there was that amazing whoosh of action suddenly, a frozen moment, and then holy, everybody charging. And I was one of the group, Rosie Greer, Plimpton, others, who slammed into Sirhan and started wrestling for the pistol and bringing his arm down. And because his arm was going down, a lot of the people behind Kennedy got shot in the leg. Not a lot, but two or three people got shot in the legs because the arm was being forced down until they finally got the gun out of his hand. And for me, the reporter took over. After one moment of initial rage, throwing a punch over somebody's shoulder, I started just making notes. I became a recording machine and watched as they slammed Sirhan up on these steam tables and pulled him way down the kitchen, length of the kitchen. Bobby was on the floor. I thought he was shot in the chest because there was blood on his shirt and on his fingers, but it was because his hand had brushed his head above and behind the ear where the bullet, the first of three bullets, entered him, and he got it on his fingertips. And I remember so clearly Jesse Unruh, who was the head of the Democratic Party in California, running around saying, "No Dallas, no Dallas, no Dallas," meaning they didn't want Sirhan to be killed the way Jack Ruby killed Lee Harvey Oswald the next day after Dallas.
Don't kill the evidence.
Yeah, don't kill the killer. Try to find out what he's made of, who he is, what's this about, etc. And of course, that prevailed. They kept him alive.
And refresh our memories about what Sirhan's motivations were.
Well, one of the motivations was, see, at the time, nobody knew who he was. But one of the motivations was came from the Middle East. Bob Kennedy had supported the sale of jets to Israel.
Jet fighters.
The PLO, which had been formed only the year before, after the 67 war in Israel, the PLO apparently... Sirhan was not exactly a member. There was no branch office of the PLO in Southern California, and he'd been there a couple of years. But his sympathies were there because he was a Palestinian. And in the diaries that they later found, there was of Sirhan's, and they exist. They've been in the public domain for years. RFK must die, RFK must die, RFK must die, RFK, written, scribbled across pages, almost like a self-hypnotic use of words in his own solitude. And he went out, and as any one of these guys has always been able to do, he got a gun and he got through security and got in, such as it was, and got into the place where he could make that chant come true.
What impact did Bobby Kennedy's assassination have on you personally?
Well, you know, I came back to go to the funeral, and then I was on the train and all that.
The train that took his body
that
from...
That took his body to Washington.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And all through that, I was still more or less functioning fairly well.
Because you were reporting, probably.
Yeah, I was reporting, and I wanted to write the thing and try to get it down as accurately as I could. But when all that was over, when Bobby was buried and the story moved to another chapter somewhere, for the first and only time in my life, I had a writer's block. I couldn't write. I was sitting there saying, what's the point of all this? What am I doing? And I couldn't work. And I had my daughters were two little girls at the time. They were 3 and 5, and they were used to me working, and they'd see me staring out the window or something. I went back to Mexico with them on a trip, because Mexico always had the ability to heal what bothered me. I needed to drown in bowels, and came back on the 4th of July and back up to New York. And I ran into Paul O'Dwyer, who was a wonderful, older, Irish guy, politician, lawyer, permanent defense attorney. And he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Nothing." He said, "Why?" I said, "I got a writer's block, Paul." O'Dwyer looked at me and said, "You're not important enough to have a writer's block. What are you doing?" And I laughed out loud, and he laughed, and I started writing the next day. But you need that Irish thing every once in a while if you're not only because you're Irish, but because you have to get up off the floor and say, "Okay, let's make a left at the next corner."
So what impact did the assassination have on you politically?
Well, it didn't change my politics in any way. What it made me, as a columnist, I became more political. I didn't want to go and spend the rest of my life mourning Robert Kennedy or acting as if all those ideas were foolish. It wasn't the ideas that killed him. It was the gun, the guy with the gun. So in my journalism, I became quite political for a while, thinking rather than going to mass every June or something and praying for his soul and all that, it would be better to take his ideas and his passions and keep him present sometimes when I had to think about something. What would Bobby think? Would this column dishonor his memory or something? I would think that way. He was a presence, but not in a conventional way.
My guest is Pete Hamill. We'll continue our remembrance of Robert F. Kennedy after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're devoting today's show to the memory of Robert Kennedy. He was assassinated 40 years ago. Let's get back to our interview with journalist Pete Hamill, who was a friend of Kennedy's and was with him the night he was killed. Bobby Kennedy's assassination was on the night that he won the California primary. And you were with him then. You'd worked for his campaign. Has that experience affected how you've viewed this year's primary?
Yes, it has. I mean, the process, I don't mean the ideas or the style necessarily, but the process of offering yourself to immense crowds, to turn politics into a kind of show or a form of almost religious ceremony at different points, is amazingly dangerous. People read the paper, the nutcases read the paper along with the decent people, and you never know what the availability of candidate A, B, C, or D might create in a warped head. So, it's impossible for those of us who either were present that night 40 years ago and erupted into tears and anger, and it's impossible to ask us not to think of comparisons in a campaign like this one. And we're stuck because we have a tradition of going out among the crowds and pressing the flesh, and even if they're fake photo ops, a shot in a beer picture and that kind of thing, there's still moments of availability in a country with too many guns. And if there were any way to honor Kennedy and all the others who died for the things they believed in, you would think it would begin with getting the gun out of American life. And there's more guns now than ever, and more politicians afraid of the NRA and telling us that guns are American. I'd like to think they're not.
Now, I should mention that Robert Kennedy didn't even have Secret Service protection, because at the time you didn't get Secret Service unless you were the party's official candidate.
Exactly. And Sam Yorty hated Kennedy, the mayor of Los Angeles, and he wouldn't provide security from the LAPD. So he thanked him, actually, from the stage that last night in the ballroom, in again, an ironical way. And everybody got the gag and all cheered. But even then, you're so amazingly vulnerable. Obama appeared before a crowd of 75,000. I mean, that's like four Knicks games in Oregon a couple of weeks ago. Who knew was out there?
You know, as we mentioned, when you urged Robert Kennedy to run for president, you were in Ireland writing a thriller about the assassination of the Pope.
Yes.
How did that plot sound to you after the assassination? Did you publish the book the way you'd written it?
I did, actually. I had finished it. So it was finally published, and I wouldn't even go to promote it. I couldn't bring myself to go out and try to make a dollar on the basic notion of assassinating somebody world known. So it's around in Alibris and out-of-print bookstores, but I haven't read it in 40-odd years.
The 40th anniversary of Bobby Kennedy's assassination coincides with the diagnosis of his brother Ted having brain cancer. You want to just reflect on that for a moment?
Well, again, I think the way that Teddy has handled this is part of that, what I call Irish fatalism, you know, where you laugh at death. And I think that's an honorable way to face it. You know, where I grew up among Irish immigrants, the ones that Bobby was so curious about because he was, you know, three or four generations separated from the Irish immigrant experience. My parents were from Ireland, from Belfast. There was a sense that the worst sin of all was cruelty. But the second worst sin was self-pity. No matter what you did, you weren't allowed to feel sorry for yourself. You get up and go to work. And I think that's an admirable thing that the Kennedys, these remember, that family had amazing fortunes. They could have, those young guys, Jack and Teddy and Bobby, could have spent their lives sitting on the Riviera drinking highballs and watching the sunset, which they didn't do. They went out and tried to give something back to the country that had been so kind and generous to their, and to the people that got them there. So I think that's the part I admire about them. They didn't act as if they were in our past. They went out and tried to do something for people who were not as well off as they were. And it's one of the things I think I'll go to my grave feeling about them.
Will you be doing anything special on the anniversary to reflect or, you know, honor Robert Kennedy's life?
I don't know. It's a good idea. I haven't thought about it. But the trouble is, a lot of my friends who I think of about that night, you mentioned Jack Newfield, have now passed away. And you can't go on a street corner and stand there yelling, "Remember, remember," to the crowd. I think you'd do it privately and then get up the next morning and go to work.
Pete Hamill, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Pete Hamill wrote the introduction to a new book collecting photos of Bobby Kennedy taken by Bill Eppridge. It's called A Time It Was. The late journalist Jack Newfield was a friend of Hamill and Bobby Kennedy. Newfield traveled with Kennedy from November 1966 until the assassination and wrote a biography of him. 10 years ago, on the 30th anniversary of Kennedy's assassination, I spoke with Newfield. Here's a brief excerpt.
When you were following Robert Kennedy on his presidential campaign, did you think he was going to win?
I did not actually think he was going to win until like the last half hour of his life. Just that last night in California. He had lost the Oregon primary the week before, partly because he supported gun control in a state with a lot of hunters. Everything was riding on California. He had a win in California, and the same day there was a primary in South Dakota, which is the state Hubert Humphrey was born in, although he later became the senator for Minnesota. And that night, the last night of his life, he not only won California by 5 percentage points, he also won in South Dakota. In about a half hour before he went down to the ballroom to claim his victory, he had a phone conversation with Mayor Daley of Chicago. And Mayor Daley all but promised to throw the Illinois delegates to Bobby at the convention in August in 1968. And I think he said to me and Pete Hamill at that point, Daley is the ball game, and I think we have Daley. And then one of the most moving things for me was the night before his funeral, I went into St. Patrick's Cathedral with a group of friends that included Tom Hayden, who was then a leader of Students for a Democratic Society, and was organizing the protest at the 1968 convention. And I was asked to stand vigil at the casket at some point in the middle of the night, and Mayor Daley was there. And he and I, who did not admire each other, were both standing over the casket of Robert Kennedy and tears running down our cheeks. And Tom Hayden, who was further back in St. Patrick's, I could hear him crying. And then 10 weeks later, when the Democratic Party was almost destroyed by the armies led by Tom Hayden in the street and the Chicago police working for Mayor Daley, I thought back to that moment and that Robert Kennedy was the only possible person who could have unified Mayor Daley and Tom Hayden and myself behind one candidacy, and that those riots and violence never would have happened if Bob had not been killed. And I think if he had been nominated, he certainly would have defeated Richard Nixon. And that's a gigantic fork in the road to get Richard Nixon instead of Robert Kennedy.
Where were you when Robert Kennedy was murdered?
I was in the fifth floor of the hotel. I was watching. He went downstairs, and I wanted to avoid the crush of people. And John Lewis, who's a close friend of mine, who is now a congressman from Atlanta, he and I stayed behind to watch the victory speech on TV in a suite on the fifth floor that Bob had just vacated. And we watched it on television in the hotel. And then we ran downstairs when we realized that shots had been fired. And later that night, me and John and Cesar Chavez went to the hospital, and which is where it hit me that this was Robert Kennedy's coalition, and people like Chavez and John Lewis were now orphans in history. That I felt Robert Kennedy's presidency would have been the logical climax of the 1960s, that everything that had happened for 8 years was pointing towards Robert Kennedy's presidency to end the Vietnam War, and it was just aborted in front of our eyes. It was as Marshall Gans, who was an organizer for Chavez, says in the film, as Robert Kennedy, as the gunshots rang out and you knew what happened, he said, "I could feel history slipping through my fingers."
The late journalist Jack Newfield recorded 10 years ago. We'll conclude our remembrance of Robert Kennedy and hear from his son Max after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're remembering Robert Kennedy. He was assassinated 40 years ago. We're going to conclude with an excerpt of an interview I recorded with his son Max on the 30th anniversary of the assassination. Max Kennedy was 3 when his father was killed. When we spoke, he had just edited a collection of his father's speeches. I asked Max to read what Robert Kennedy said to a crowd in Indianapolis after the assassination of Martin Luther King.
These words were spoken, I don't know if you know, Terry, but my father was scheduled to speak in Indianapolis that evening, and while he was on the plane, he got word that Dr. King had been shot and was going to die. This announcement had not been made public, so it fell to my father to give this terrible news to the people of Indianapolis. And he was scheduled to speak in what was then called the ghetto. And as his escort drove into one of the poorest areas in the city, the police who were escorting him pulled away and refused to drive in. My father's car continued, but the car carrying his speech followed the police officers. So he found himself that night in this very poor area with no speech. And he started by saying, "I have bad news for you, for all of our fellow citizens, and for people who love peace all over the world. And that is that Martin Luther King was shot and killed tonight." And at that point on the recording, there's a terrible gasp from the crowd. And then my father picks up again and he says, "Martin Luther King dedicated his life to love and to justice for his fellow human beings, and he died because of that effort. In this difficult day, in this difficult time for the United States, it is perhaps well to ask what kind of a nation we are and what direction we want to move in. For those of you who are black, considering the evidence there evidently is that there were white people who were responsible, you can be filled with bitterness, with hatred, and with a desire for revenge. We can move in that direction as a country, in great polarization, black people amongst black, white people amongst white, filled with hatred toward one another. Or we can make an effort, as Martin Luther King did, to understand and to comprehend, and to replace that violence, that stain of bloodshed that has spread across our land, with an effort to understand with compassion and love. For those of you who are black and are tempted to be filled with hatred and distrust at the injustice of such an act against all white people, I can only say that I feel in my own heart the same kind of feeling. I had a member of my family killed, but he was killed by a white man. But we have to make an effort in the United States. We have to make an effort to understand, to go beyond these rather difficult times. And then he quoted from memory his favorite poet, Aeschylus, and he said, "My favorite poet was Aeschylus. He wrote, 'In our sleep, pain which cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart, until in our own despair, against our will, comes wisdom through the awful grace of God.'" And he finished that speech by asking the people there to go back to their homes and to say a prayer for the family of Martin Luther King and also to say a prayer for the United States. And the remarkable thing is that that night there were riots across the country. I think there were riots in 186 cities and towns in the United States, and Indianapolis was quiet.
Max Kennedy, did that speech give you any clues on dealing with your father's assassination?
Yes, I think it definitely did. It's really a remarkable speech. I think that when a violent act occurs like that, the temptation is immediately to respond with hatred and with anger and with a vengeful heart. And the lesson that my father tried to give is to, you know, the old Christian ethic, which is to try to respond with love. And in fact, I took the title of this book from something he said later that same night in that same speech. He said to this incredibly poor audience, who had every right to be unimaginably angry, he went back and he quoted the ancient Greeks again, which I think is a remarkable thing, and he said, "Let us dedicate ourselves to what the Greeks wrote so many years ago, to tame the savageness of man and make gentle the life of this world." And I mean, in the final analysis, my feeling is that this world could still use a lot more gentleness.
Max Kennedy talking about his father, Robert Kennedy, in an interview recorded 10 years ago. Robert Kennedy was assassinated 40 years ago after declaring victory in the June 4th California Democratic primary. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, Patty Leswing, and Jonathan Menjivar. I'm Terry Gross.